I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, March 20th, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present today: Senator Dunbar, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Klayman. Senator Myers is on the phone with us right now. Vice Chair Wilikowski is tied up in a committee hearing. This is, and I am Senator Giesel. I believe Senator Rauscher will be joining us shortly. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Susan, who are recording the minutes of this meeting and helping us out with the audio. Today on the agenda, we have one item, and that's Senate Bill 275. That's the natural gas projects, income tax, and surcharge. We will be continuing a presentation by Gaffney Klein from Wednesday. First of all, however, I wanted to ask Senator Dunbar if he would like to comment on some a news article he saw recently. Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I Senate Labor and Commerce went long, so I didn't get a chance to this afternoon. Excuse me. So I believe this has been posted on BASIS.
It has.
This article I read this morning and I sent to my colleagues. It's titled "How LNG Projects Really Gets FID and What It Takes to Be Part of the Gulf Coast Wave." It's by RBN Energy, which is a industry publication. And there's a number of interesting points in here. They actually go broader in the article than just the Gulf Coast. They talk about projects in Virginia and I believe one in South Carolina. They mention the possibility of projects in Mexico. And they talk about the three primary hurdles for FID. The first is regulatory approvals, which, of course, we have in Alaska. The second is feed gas supply, and they claim that you need to have multiple feed gas suppliers amounting to 1.2 to 1.4 of their nameplate export capacity, typically. And the third is binding commercial offtake agreements, which, of course, our project doesn't have. The other reason this article struck was interesting to me is that Alaska isn't mentioned at all. And I found it to be sort of odd. And so I sent them a message asking, is this because you wanted to focus on that region, or do you not see the AKLNG project as sort of likely to go forward in the future? Because they were describing six and potentially more of what they saw as the largest and most likely LNG projects to go forward in the near future. And one of them was a Glenfarne project on the Gulf Coast. I haven't received a response from them yet, but I think it's interesting that in a discussion about LNG export from North America, that Alaska wasn't mentioned. That's all, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Yeah, that was an interesting article, and I appreciate you sending that forward. You know, one of the things that some of you may be receiving as well, getting emails on this subject from citizens. And by and large, 99% of those emails that I've been receiving have been thank yous for taking the time to dig into this project and into maximizing the benefit to Alaskans. You know, I tell people, I think everyone on this committee very much supports a North Slope gas pipeline project. We've been waiting for decades for one, more than 40 years. It'll bring energy to the rail belt, but it also will be a source of revenue for our state treasury and the permanent fund. So we are digging in, and we're carefully scrutinizing this and making sure that it does benefit Alaskans. You know, one of the recent books that certainly has been circulating in the building is called How Big Things Get Done: The Surprising Factors That Determine the Fate of Every Project by Bent Flyberg and Dan Gardner. It's copyright 2023. And interestingly, the underlying thesis of the authors, who have done significant research into mega projects and smaller projects, the underlying philosophy is make haste slowly. And they talk about the iron law of project management, which is over budget, over time, under benefits, over and over again. And so one of the things that they really encourage is, at the beginning, take the time to review every aspect of the project, ask a lot of questions, and experiment. That is, ask those questions of what if. What if we did this? How would that possibly turn out? But at the end of the day, that the projects, and they cite projects in here from very long ago right up to current times, where they took the time to really carefully plan. It turned out spectacularly. And then, of course, the ones that people said, we've got to hurry and get this done. This is urgent. And they were fiascos. So very interesting. Very interesting, similar to what we have heard from our consultant Pegasus, who analyzed what happened under TAPS, the significant cost overrun and overtime cost. So interesting. I think we need to keep asking those questions that we've been asking. And one of the people we've been asking questions to is Gaffney Klein. We have them as our consultant, and Nick Fulford is here today with us. Senator Klayman.
Just a follow-up on your comment about the book, because I am reading the same book. And I share the interest in the authors in what projects work and what projects don't. And one of the early examples in the book is the Empire State Building. And when we think about how long does it take to build, they've started construction and finished the Empire State Building in 3 years, which is, if we think about it in today's construction time projects, it's jaw-droppingly remarkable. And I think it was probably jaw-droppingly remarkable even in the 1920s and 30s when they built the Empire State Building. And it's a reminder that these kinds of big projects, the planning is really essential, and understanding the details is essential.
Yes.
So thank you for bringing the book up.
So we have today again with us Nick Fulford. He's the Senior Director, LNG and Energy Transition with Gaffney Klein. With him is Fernando Rollo. He's the Senior Economist with Gaffney Klein. Also online, four questions. Matt Kissinger, Commercial Director of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Frank Richards, the President of the same organization. And Tim Navarre, online just listening. So, Mr. Fulford, welcome. We concluded our last meeting on we were just approaching slide 19, which is titled Surcharge Implications. So I will turn the meeting over to you to continue on. I'm certainly interested in any comments you might have about Senator Dunbar's article or the philosophy and the books that Senator Klayman and I were just discussing. Mr. Fulford.
Thank you, Chair Giesel, and good afternoon, committee members. For the record, my name is Nicholas Fulford, Senior Director of Gas and LNG at Gaffney Klein. As you mentioned, Madam Chair, today's presentation continues the scene setting that we provided on Wednesday, and I'll be referring back to some of that work as we go through the materials. So, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, we're now at the point where we're talking about the surcharge that is proposed, a processing surcharge, which would be applicable only to the LNG volumes and not to the in-state volumes. But before we launch into a discussion about the size of the surcharge and how it affects the project economics, I think it's useful to consider essentially two scenarios. You'll recall from the materials from Wednesday that one of the main goals of any LNG project is to reduce the levelized cost of LNG delivery and to maximize the price that you get for the LNG up to the point where there's sufficient economic rent to, in this case, to pay a suitable price to the upstream producer, and also to generate adequate returns on the processing, the pipeline, and the LNG. So in a way, looking at the surcharge, it's useful to look at two scenarios, really. One is a scenario where there's sufficient economic rent in the entire chain, such that all those requirements are met, that the gas is purchased, the shareholders are happy, and there's sufficient headroom to fund the 15% surcharge and indeed, you know, potentially other features. In that scenario, you could argue that the surcharge is characteristic of the legislature pursuing its constitutional obligation to make sure that if there's economic rent, that the people of Alaska are getting their fair share of that economic rent. The other scenario, of course, is that with chiseling down the capex, with optimizing the capital structure, securing whatever federal support you can, that you're still not quite at that point where that economic rent is just able to kind of wash its face. In which case, the risk of the surcharge is essentially slowing down the process to FID or even suspending the dialogue on the project. So I think it's useful, as you think about the surcharge and the quantum, it's useful to consider those two scenarios because we don't yet know which side of that line that we sit. And in a way, that also is a reference back to the discussions we had about transparency and creating an awareness amongst legislative decision makers such that everyone has some sense of where we are on that line from profitability to lack thereof. So with that preamble, let's look at the moment for a moment at what that 15 cents represents.
Mr. Fulford,
we've got a list here. Madam Chair.
Mr. Fulford, thank you for that preface. And you referred to transparency. I have a question here from Senator Myers. He has a question on slide 18. If you would kindly go back to slide 18. Senator Myers, please state your question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Fulford, on slide 18, we've got mentioned a number of projects that have been built in the last few years, LNG projects. And there's a bit on there talking about transparency and what was shared with the host government for each of those projects. My question is exactly what part of the government that information was shared with. It's my understanding, doing a little bit of research between Wednesday and today, that in each of those cases, that information was shared with either a state or a government executive branch agency, such as a Ministry of Petroleum, or with a specific government-owned enterprise that would be somewhat analogous to AGDC. And then the sharing with the legislative body was relatively minimal. Would you say that that's an accurate characterization?
Thank you, Senator Myers, and through the chair. Yes, I would say that's a fairly accurate representation. Certainly for one or two of the projects on the left-hand side, particularly the ones in East Africa, at Gaffney Klein were reasonably familiar with some of those projects and how the government dialogue typically takes place. And, you know, that often goes into what's called the HGA host government agreement. And I would say the people who are within that dialogue and have access to, if not the model itself, certainly the findings from it, it can vary quite a bit. But it would certainly go up to a kind of a ministerial level, some of whom would be also elected officials. But as we spoke about on Wednesday, at the end of the day, you know, the global LNG business is highly competitive, especially at the moment, that there are quite a number of projects either wanting to or about to start delivery of LNG. And obviously the returns, the margins and so forth are highly commercially sensitive. So there is typically a confidentiality framework that goes around this, but access to the economics you know, can typically cover both the national gas company, if you like, key ministries, and potentially doubling up with some elected officials.
Follow up, Senator Myers.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So in the bill that we're discussing here, we're putting in confidentiality agreements and actually a requirement that that AGDC and the developer sign those confidentiality agreements if requested by an individual legislator. And looking at these other projects that you listed, did you find anything similar where it's, you know, not necessarily, you know, just a particular ministry or branch of the executive side, but with individual elected officials, with individual members of the legislative branch that have that type of access?
Yes, thank you, Senator Myers, and through the chair. I would have to go back and review certainly the projects where we have some line of sight into how these discussions are being conducted. I would have to check that specific detail in order to verify whether there's an equivalence anywhere.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Fulford, I'll let you go forward.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So as I was saying, it's useful to consider the proposed surcharge and where it sits in terms of order of magnitude. So as we look at the 15 cents per MMBTU or per 1,000 cubic feet, the government revenues come out almost exactly the same as the state corporate income tax on the pipeline, roughly $150, $160 million per annum. It's, you know, as you look at the pipeline, based on the numbers that we presented the other day, so these are just illustrative, they're not based on the project, but at least it gives you a sense of where that, you know, where that magnitude sits. In terms of property tax, it's the equivalent of a property tax of about 2 mils. Looking at it in terms of delivered sales, and this is using a $10 delivered charge, which obviously is significantly less than what exists today. It's about a 1.5% sales tax, put it that way. The next bullet is actually, apologize, it's a mistake. It should be 1/5 of the shipping cost, but nevertheless, it's a good illustration. And then, you know, when you look at other attributes of the project, such as, for example, the 45Q tax credits that might be applicable from the gas treatment plant, it's potentially in the region of about 25% of what that might be. Then the last one on here is just one I put out of interest. It's a very theoretical feature, but I was interested in the 15 cents in the context of the sort of basic efficiency advantages that exist in Canada, in Alaska, and Canada too, actually. So out of interest, that if you were to relocate an LNG plant from Texas and move it to Nikiski, the change in ambient temperature would drive about $150 or $200 million worth of additional LNG output that you're not burning in the compressors. So in that context, the 15% surcharge is about 75% of that quantum. As I say, highly theoretical, but all the same, it's sort of illustrative of the rounding and the kind of assumptions around, you know, plant performance that would exist. So then if we look in terms of IRR, we've taken a 10% post-tax IRR, which you recall from the numbers we presented on Wednesday. So if without any other changes, if the 15% surcharge is applied and the project is driving a post-tax IRR of 10%, it would reduce it by about a third of a percent. So puts it down to about 9.64%. And again, just to emphasize, these numbers are illustrative. It depends on a whole range of assumptions. But for the purposes of today's debate, I felt that was a useful guide. So with that, I'm ready to move to the next slide, unless there are questions.
Let me see if there are questions. I see none.
Okay. So on the next slide, we've talked a lot about Canadian comparisons simply because the concept and the economics of the two projects, Alaska LNG versus, for example, LNG Canada, there are many, many comparisons. And for that reason, it's helpful to look at the tax comparison. So in Canada, you've got a federal corporate income tax rate of 15%, BC provincial rate of 12%. They don't compound, so you just add them up. So that would put you at a 27% overall combined corporate income tax rate. But in the final negotiations to get that project to FID, one of the fiscal package features which was introduced and agreed to by the BC government was a 3% so-called natural gas credit, which would effectively bring the corporate income tax provincially down to a floor of 9%. So the overall taxation rate there, we've got 24% or so with the credit. If we do the same, this is excluding property tax, by the way, this second section, 21.94, which conflate into 28.43, a familiar number that the committee will have seen many times. So then if we were to add the 15 cents per MMBTU per 1,000 cubic feet surcharge, effectively that changes the effective tax rate from 28.43 to somewhere between 29.5 and 30.5, depending on how it's treated. So again, it's a useful comparison. And, you know, obviously LNG Canada has other material differences, including the way they buy their gas, which is typically at numbers higher than we've seen talked about for Alaska. But all the same, it's useful to look at it in terms of the competitiveness of Alaska versus British Columbia and the overall tax take. So with that, I'll pause for questions.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just sort of note that one of the advantages Canada has over the United States whenever any corporation is setting up a facility there is they don't have to pay for their employees' health insurance, which is a very substantial cost. But set that to the side and just talk about this. So is this just the LNG processing plant, which is what we were talking about on the prior slide, or is this the entire project, which is essentially three projects combined? And then am I reading this right, that there is no surcharge on the BC project, on the LNG export of the BC project?
Yes, thank you, Senator Dunbar, and through the chair. So these provincial and federal corporate income tax rates would also apply to the gas pipeline, which is separately owned. It's owned by a consortium, including TransCanada. So effectively, the LNG project pays a tariff to the pipeline company. But I believe these same tax rates would apply to the profits generated from that as well. The big difference between Alaska and Canada is that the CO2 removal plant isn't a requirement. The the project essentially takes pipeline quality gas from the sort of Montney producing area. And one way of looking at the difference between in economics, you know, between Alaska and Canada is that in very basic terms, if you add together the cost of gas processing and CO2 removal with the cost of buying gas from the North Slope, it needs to more or less equate to the price that LNG Canada is paying for gas in the Montney, which is a matter of public record because it's a traded hub. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's just one perhaps way of looking at it. And the other point to note is that property taxes at Kitimat are of the order of, you know, a few million dollars, way less than 10. So that would be the other major difference between the fiscal regime.
And there is no MBTU surcharge at the Canadian project, is that correct?
That's correct. And in fact, that's effectively it's the reverse of a surcharge in the sense that there is this natural gas credit, which is used to offset provincial corporate income tax.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Mr. Fulford, I may have been misunderstanding you, but let me just ask a clarifying question. The 15 cents per MMBTU is charged on the LNG processing plant in Nikiski, not the CO2 facility on the North Slope. Is that your understanding as well?
It is, Madam Chair. That's how we've looked at it.
All right. Thank you. It sounded like you were including that CO2 facility, and so I just wanted to clarify. All right.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to clarify. The analogy that I was making with the processing plant was simply that it isn't required in Canada.
Gotcha. Do you know, perhaps, of course, you said it was public information. What is the selling price for gas at the wellhead in Canada?
So the quickest and easiest way to make that comparison is to look at the traded gas prices at a hub called Station 2, which is in kind of it's at the westerly end of the pipeline system in the Lower 48 in Canada. So Station 2 and there's another AECO, that's it, AECO is the other hub that's nearby. So roughly speaking, that would be roughly the guide. In my last set of slides for Senate Resources a couple of months or maybe a few weeks ago, I actually had a graph which showed the forward price for Station 2, which for the most part is $2, maybe rising to $3. I don't want to get off the topic too much, but one of the interesting features is that effectively that Station 2 price is linked with Henry Hub. It operates at a basis differential from Henry Hub. So if we saw Henry Hub prices rising, which they are because of the additional draw of all the LNG on the Gulf Coast, you would also expect to see Station 2 rise, which improves potentially Alaska's competitiveness against LNG Canada.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. It actually looked up your previous.
I think I might have got the wrong information. I had to pay to log in to see it.
Oh, I see. All right, never mind. He was looking at
it. It looked like it said $1.66, but that sounds like it's too low. You think it's closer to $3?
Yes, that is Dunbar through the chair. I can easily send you the forward curve because currently prices are relatively low, but the forward price suggests that will increase quite significantly.
Very good. I see no further questions.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Oh, pardon me. I'm sorry, Senator Myers, if I missed you. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Fulford, I'm curious kind of what the wedge effect of this type of per unit surcharge might be. I can kind of see three possibilities how it gets pulled into the economics. I'm curious if you have a guess as to which one is most likely to happen. I could see it potentially leading to a lower price for the gas getting sold off of the slope, which then could mean lower royalties for the state. I could see it being a lower profit, lower rate of return for the pipe and processing facility owners, and I could see it passed on as a higher price to the East Asian customers. Which of those three do you think is most likely to happen?
Thank you, Senator Dunbar, and through the chair. I forget which order you said them in, but I think the LNG market will support a certain price. And on Wednesday, we began talking about the security of supply reliability issues, which might start to creep in. But putting those aside, that there are many LNG projects seeking to sell their gas to the big buyers. And so I think it's unlikely that that 15 cents could be passed on to the LNG buyer in Asia. Equally, the North Slope producers will have a certain hurdle rate and a certain price that they are keen to secure for their gas. And clearly that will be part of a negotiation, because at the end of the day, you know, the net present value of selling that gas through the LNG project is many billions of dollars. So much better that you sell the gas at some price than necessarily at the highest. So it's possible there could be some negotiation with the North Slope providers in terms of how that price gets sold, how that gas gets sold. But I think for the most part, it's likely to depress the economics of the three elements of the LNG project. So if you were to assume that third scenario, you'd be generating $165 million of revenue through the surcharge, and then you'd be losing maybe 15, 16 million dollars in corporate income tax because of the lower profitability. So it's about a 10-to-1 ratio, as you would expect with a 9.4 rate.
Follow-up, Senator?
Okay, thank you.
All right.
No, I'm good. Thank you, Madam.
All right, thank you. I see no further questions.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, with that, we'll move. Perhaps we'll pause for a moment on the title slide for the next section, which deals with the lease operating expense. When I made the introduction to these slides on Wednesday, I pointed out that of all the features in this bill, the difference in treatment of lease operating expense is probably, it's certainly one of the most material, and it's also the most difficult to evaluate. As everyone on the committee knows very well, modeling upstream oil taxes with the net tax mechanism that exists today is very, very complex, and because it's so heavily dependent on oil price, it's hard to, you know, really put a firm value on that. But before we get to that, clearly, you know, as the gas infrastructure, or as the oil and gas infrastructure on the slope moves towards gas production and away from liquids, you know, depending on the field and depending on the circumstances, you know, that will require some degree of capital investment on behalf of the producers. Just to give the committee some guidelines, one of the condensate fields that's very similar to Point Thompson in terms of gas in place would be the Brent field in the North Sea. It had a lot more liquids associated with it, but the gas is roughly the same. So when that was converted from liquids production to gas, to the gas blowdown phase, the capital investment required to do that was about £1 billion, a little bit more, and it involved essentially suspending the facilities for quite some time. So that's an example, and really only the operators will be able to provide guidance on what's considered for Point Thompson, for example. But in that sense, you know, Point Thompson, $4 billion publicly reported in terms of capital investment so far. So, you know, in terms of replacing the compression, potentially additional gas wells to bring up the gas volumes. And the other thing to bear in mind is that there would have to be a life extension program to go with that field. So 15, 20 years of additional life. So if you add all those things up, it's potentially a fairly major capital investment. So again, to provide some illustrative numbers, let's say it's $1 billion. Now, modeling that $1 billion capital expenditure through the net profits mechanism for oil is a very, very complex task. Maybe DOR would have some insight into the numbers to do that. But for the purposes of today's meeting and the committee, if we were to take that $1 billion and apply that to the gross gas tax that would apply, so 13%, and look at the impact of that on the price of gas being sold by the producer to the LNG project, it makes a difference of about 3 to 5 cents per MMBTU. So in other words, if the producer was allowed to use that $1 billion as an expense against their gas taxes, and not oil, not gas taxes, they would be able to sell the gas at about 3 to 5 cents less than if the lease operating expenses are completely unallowable. So as I say, it's not quite the question that's being asked, and it's, I'm sure, not quite the question which needs the analysis. But for guidance purposes, I thought it was helpful just to provide that verbal update today.
Thank you for that, Mr. Fulford. So let me just clarify then. So you are analyzing what a gross tax on the gas would look like at a 13% gross tax that you are speculating would reduce the cost of the gas by 3 to 5 cents. Am I getting that right, or do you need to correct me?
Perhaps, Madam Chair, I can re-express that because it is a fairly complex analysis. So if we assume that a 13% gross tax would be applicable after royalty, you know, based on current statute, and if we then allowed those field improvements of $1 billion to be offset against the 13% gross tax, so effectively, hypothetically, we're turning the gas gross tax into a net tax. But if you did that, then it would have, as I say, about a 3 to 5 cent effect on the gas price. So I know that's not being proposed, but for the purposes of illustrating where some of these numbers might lead to, I felt it was at least one way to express an order of magnitude.
Very interesting.
I think to answer the question properly, you would have to plug that $1 billion or whatever we think is the right number into the net oil taxation, which the field is currently subject to. And this applies obviously not just to Point Thompson, but Prudhoe Bay and potentially other units on the slope.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I may submit to you a request for some other modeling as well on that. Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to comment on that, I think one of the challenges of allowing that kind of expense to be used against the taxes, as we've seen in other contexts, is it removes any incentives to hold down costs, especially if you have subcontractors that you are working very closely with. Why not build a more expensive facility so that you can, I mean, there's no difference to you. You're going to turn around and you're going to write it off. And it leads to incredible complication and difficulty from the state of Alaska trying to determine what is and is not a legitimate lease expense. And then we get lawsuits and audits and commissioners potentially writing things off at pennies on the dollar. And I know why we would want to go down that road, but I just don't think it's worked particularly well in other contexts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Fulford, do other regimes allow the write-off of CapEx, and to what extent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's worth pointing out that if we think back to that table of LNG projects that we were looking at earlier in the slide deck, many of those are in jurisdictions which have a production sharing contract arrangement. And in that case, essentially all the allowable costs or all the costs of the gas infrastructure are recovered by the producer before the before the taxes start to get paid. So before you start to generate profit gas from which the government generates income. So very, very different concept of tax. But under a production sharing agreement, typically these costs would be allowable. And some of the best written agreements, and I can think of some in East Africa, for example, are very well written in a way that there's heavy kind of audit rights by the government entities. There are clear rules about how any contracts are let to prevent contracts which aren't essentially arm's length or where they are related parties that they're suitably priced. So they come with a range of safeguards, but they would involve essentially allowing development costs against tax.
Thank you. Further questions? All right, seeing none, that must move us to slide 23, the gas processing plant.
Yes, thank you. Again, the gas processing plant is, I think, for many people, not the main focus of the bill, but I thought it was worth taking a little bit of a deeper dive into what that gas processing plant does, because as Senate Bill 275 or its sort of subsequent amendments starts to evolve, the processing plant has some features which might require a little bit of extra care in terms of drafting and how things are allowable and the cash flows operate. So I think, everyone on the committee, and I'm sure many listening at home you know, understand the purpose of the treatment plant. Prudhoe Bay, Point Thompson both have significant CO2 content. And the to even bring that gas to a pipeline spec requires quite a good deal of CO2 removal and treatment for various other impurities. As I think is well understood, liquefaction plants require an order of magnitude cleaner gas to function properly. And so the concept has always been with AKLNG that that cleanup process to this very, very high specification would happen in this one plant on the North Slope, as opposed to having to do it again when you get it down to Nikiski. So it will produce significant quantities of CO2. A number of volumes have been talked about, but certainly very substantial compared to any kind of CO2 plant. Interestingly, carbon capture has become a fairly standard feature now of most of the Gulf Coast LNG plants. It's partly because they have to remove the CO2 for the plant to work properly. But by sequestering it, which is, again, the plan for the North Slope, LNG buyers have they're provided with a lower carbon product, and their shareholders and others can feel better about buying the LNG with this lower carbon content and potentially pay a premium for it. So the other feature is the use of the CO2, because you'll hear the acronym CCUS. So it stands for carbon capture, use, and sequestration. So this is an example where use of the CO2 is indeed feasible. And its typical use in the Lower 48 is for what they call immiscible flood. It's used to pressurize oil reservoirs to really bring out the last few million barrels of oil that's recoverable. And although I don't think it's currently done in the North Slope, there are technical papers which suggest that at some point, Prudhoe Bay and other fields can be produced for a longer period of time using CO2 pressurization. And, you know, 2 to 5 barrels of recovered oil per ton of CO2 is the goal that people strive for. So what you see quite frequently associated with carbon capture plants is a sale of the CO2 to an oil producer. When it's done on an arm's length basis, it can be cents per ton. Sometimes it can be as much as, say, $20 a ton. So it's quite likely, I think, that the CO2 removal plant owner might enter into a sale and purchase agreement for CO2 in order to sell the gas to generate higher oil production. So on the next slide, unless there are questions on that one, I will talk about the tax credits in a bit more detail.
Yes, please. I'll let you go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a feature of the project that AGDC have talked about quite extensively. It's a very beneficial feature, and at the moment, certainly one of the quite significant economic incentives for doing carbon capture and sequestration is $85 per ton federal tax credit, which can be applied in suitable circumstances. The credits last for 12 years after operation, and at the moment there's a construction limit of January the 1st, 2033 for a project to qualify. One of the problems, however, with tax credits is that they're there needs to be a tax-paying entity that can use them. And I think many on the committee are obviously familiar with tax credits and how they work because of the mechanisms that were introduced a few years ago in Alaska. But what we see quite frequently in the lower 48 is that these carbon capture plants are owned by what's typically termed a tax partnership. They're very complex structures. But the way they're set up is to enable the tax credits under 45Q to be usable and to have real value. So it's quite often for these tax credits to be sold at cents on the dollar, maybe 80 to 90 cents on the dollar, provided the plant is in these kind of tax partnership models. So on the next slide is a diagram sort of showing how all these revenue flows and so forth might come together. And it might be helpful considering that in the Alaskan context in terms of how the government take and other features of fiscal policy might apply. So with that, I would move to the next slide with the diagram, unless there are questions.
Yes, we're at that slide.
Good. I think my video has a slight lag in it, so
sure.
Apologies.
Could you wait for one moment? Senator Dunbar had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I had a question on this slide, but perhaps you can answer it in your as you go through the slide. So I guess I'm not clear who is going to own the CO2 removal plant then. It's not the LNG company. Would you anticipate it was one of these, you call it a tax partnership? Who would be members of that partnership if one of those were set up?
Yes, thank you, Senator Dunbar, and through the chair. I wouldn't want to accelerate the discussion on the carbon capture plant beyond, you know, where it is today. Other than, I think it's likely that in order to monetize the 45Q tax credits, ownership would be distinct from the other entities in the LNG chain. That's not to say that those same entities might have some kind of equity interest in the processing facility. I'm sure it's something that AGDC will comment on in due course as these details start to come together, but it seems likely that it could be a separate entity.
Interesting. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So to conclude the discussion around the gas processing plant, effectively, you have the LNG company or indeed the North Slope producers, because bearing in mind that the gas could be sold to the LNG project after it's gone through this plant, there's nothing to say the sale has to take place at the wellhead. So, and particularly if the operation of the plant with the CO2 and so forth is more operationally linked with the upstream oil and gas operations on the slope, it could be that selling clean gas to the project might be a more appropriate solution than selling untreated gas. But these are features which I'm certain Glenfarne and AGDC have been looking at for some time. But in principle, it's likely that the LNG company or the North Slope producers would ultimately pay a fee to the CO2 removal entity for the CO2 removal and sequestration. And that would be a straightforward dollars per ton on a sort of ship or pay basis. And then once the CO2 is being processed, there are sort of purely financial revenues through selling the tax credits of, you know, up to about $85 a ton. And then part of that CO2 stream could be fed back to Prudhoe Bay or one of the other fields that can benefit from this miscible flood. And additional revenues would be collected by the gas processing plant to do that. So that would then feed back into the upstream producers who would be generating additional barrels of oil, and one imagines paying additional tax on those barrels in whatever framework is appropriate at that time. So as I say, I felt it was worth highlighting some of these nuances of the gas treatment plant in the context of the legislation, because there are definitely some features which might require particular consideration as the draft progresses.
Thank you for that. Any questions for Mr. Fulford at this point? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And I apologize, Madam Chair. I had elections bill up in House Finance. And I've got an education committee I've got to run to in a few minutes, too. Curious on our obligation is to get the maximum value for our resource. We're constitutionally obligated to do that. The governor's got a bill. We've got a bill. Help us, as our expert, figure out what we need to do to get there. What information do you believe we need? And I know this is kind of a broad, big question, but I think this really is sort of the crux of what we're trying to do. We want the project to happen, but we also want to follow our constitutional obligation. And so what advice can you give us on how we can evaluate our proposal, the governor's proposal, and ensure we're protecting Alaskans' interests?
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, and through the chair. To be honest, I think the simple answer to that question is the feature that we've been discussing a little bit, both in this hearing and the ones that have previously gone before us, which is that certainly in my experience, these projects are so huge that even the suggestion that a government has somehow left money on the table is hard to contemplate for any government. And because of that, there's at some point in the project, now whether we're at that point yet or not remains to be seen, but at some point there is that reconciliation of the appropriate government take and government policies, and enabling both in this case the LNG entity and the upstream producers to achieve a suitable rate of return. And to do that, to some extent you could begin to do that work outside the tent, so to speak. You know, you can start to generate a more and more detailed financial model to try and simulate things, but there are certain fundamental aspects which, you know, are hard to estimate. That would include things like, broadly speaking, the CapEx. In this case, understanding what action the federal government might take, for example, with federal loan guarantees or using the Energy Dominance Fund to assist the project in some ways. All of these things move the levers quite significantly. But to do that work, as it were, in the dark, there's a number of risks to doing that. One is that because of the lack of clarity, the progress of fiscal arrangements and whatever deal, if you like, needs to be struck with state government slows down because of that lack of visibility, you know, or indeed that, you know, the policies are put in place which aren't compatible with the first statement that you made there, Senator, which is that everybody wants the project to go forwards. That's sort of goal number one, which is shared between the state government and the developer. Goal number two, and indeed the constitutional obligation that you that you have on your committee is to make sure that an appropriate benefit arises for the state. Anyway, that was a long and general answer, but I think ultimately it's the sharing of economic data.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. And I could date myself a little bit, but back in 2007, I believe it was Gaffney and Klein. I don't know if you were around then, but they were very helpful in creating a model for us with oil taxes. And I'm wondering, it was a comprehensive model that allowed us to plug in CapEx, OpEx numbers, percentages of increases that we might expect, production taxes, royalties, corporate income taxes, property taxes. I'm wondering if it would be possible for you or for someone, some other organization, some entity to prepare a model for us so that we could start this process of figuring out what share should we be, is fair for us, constitutionally fair for us.
Certainly, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. I mean, you know, Fernando is on the call with us today, and I work extensively with Fernando on LNG modeling. Sometimes we're given a model by, for example, a lender or a project. Sometimes we develop them ourselves. But I think with that background, it would certainly be very feasible to at least start to help the legislature kind of understand roughly where the economics of the project might come out and what the effects of different features might be. That, you know, there are some key unknowns, you know, one of which is the cost. And another is the capital structure, because both those items, you know, when we think back to our levelized cost diagram that we did the other day, both those items have a kind of fundamental effect. But anyway, starting to understand the sensitivities and the measures, I think would be, time well spent to help the legislature with a model for that.
Mr. Manager.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this project hasn't gone to FID yet, mm-hmm. and we've heard sort of varying accounts of when that might happen and how long it might take once it starts. At what point do governments usually have their entire sort of revenue structure determined before FID, or does the FID project process produce information that allows them to create that revenue structure?
Yes, thank you, Senator Dunbar, and through the chair. A couple of weeks ago, one of my colleagues, Andrew Duncan, participated in one of the hearings. And I think basically to summarize what he said, that there are examples where an FID can occur without everything being cast in stone. And those examples are typically with projects where the economic proposition, the investment case, is very robust. And so any negotiations around taxes or fiscal treatment aren't likely to have a sufficiently, you know, detrimental effect on the project that it no longer becomes viable. So it does happen. But again, you know, going back to the example of LNG Canada, FID for LNG Canada absolutely hinged on finalizing the dialogue with the federal and provincial government. That was done, I think, in maybe March or April 2018, I want to say. Maybe it was, but anyway, yeah, 2018. And then FID followed in October. And that followed about 4 or 5 years of dialogue between the project and particularly the provincial government. And the provincial government position on LNG Canada shifted from the inclusion of a special project tax, an LNG tax, a carbon tax, all the way through to, you know what, I think we need to provide a, you know, a 3% natural gas credit to allow the project to go ahead. And there are various other, there was a deferment of sales tax and a deal struck on electricity prices and so forth. And again, I think thinking back to all the LNG projects that I've been involved with, the struggle for these projects is to incrementally get to that point where the spreadsheet is showing a hurdle rate that's acceptable. It's very unusual for these projects to be so financially attractive that they can simply go ahead, you know, based on prevailing market conditions without. So the short answer to the question is government policy, state and federal, would always certainly be a prerequisite to FID.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on Senator Wilikowski's questions about a model that Gaffney Klein might be able to construct. Is that even possible without having some basic economic data that we can compare?
Thank you, Senator Klayman. And through the chair, I would agree with your assertion in the sense that you can build the most complicated model that you want, but if the assumptions aren't correct, it's, you know, the insights you get from the model are somewhat limited. They're not necessarily, you know, not usable, but they, you know, the insights that you get are limited. And in general, for any LNG project, it's probably half a dozen assumptions that will ultimately drive whether the project flies or not.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
But it seems one of our, it seems like our fundamental challenge from my perspective on this project is that we're not starting with 10 reliable pieces of information. We're essentially starting with no reliable piece of information. We have a minimum of a three-part project, and if we were to try to come up with a structure to analyze, we would have to have not six or seven assumptions, but it feels to me like we'd have to come up with somewhere between 15 and 25 assumptions with these three different projects that are linked together, and trying to come up with a meaningful analysis without data to put into it just feels like each assumption takes us farther and farther away from any reliable picture. And I'm not, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not trying to sound like just overly critical, but I'm just left with this absence of information.
Yes, Senator Klayman, I think the dialogue that we're having now on this committee is a dialogue that's played out dozens of times for projects of this sort. And, you know, clearly AGDC and Glenfarne are working very, very hard behind the scenes to get the project to the point where, you know, some degree of viability can be established. Now whether there's a point at which it will be appropriate to have that much more detailed discussion and dialogue, you know, that would be, I think, up to them to determine.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Fulford, I am intrigued by your previous comments about the complexity of a net tax structure. You talked about that a little bit ago, and we certainly have heard that our net tax structure is one of, if not the most complex in the world. And so you segued into the concept of having a gross tax. And if I'm, you can certainly correct me, but my notes say that you speculated that a gross tax of 13% on gas would result in lowering the cost of that gas by 3 to 5%. 3 to 5 cents. What? So here's my question. That was with a gross tax of 13%, you said, which I think might equate to what our net tax might be similar to. What if it were a 3.5% gross tax? Can you calculate what kind of reduction that would put on the cost of the gas?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to sort of correct, I think, the analysis, because unfortunately it wasn't on a slide. But the example I gave was currently, obviously, gas is taxed on a gross basis. It's based on the value at the wellhead or at the point of production. So the text in SB 17275 suggests a change to the oil taxation regime such that the lease operating expenses involved in investing in the gas side of the equation can no longer be claimed on the oil side of the equation. Now that, modeling that in a variety of oil price scenarios and with different other features going on with the liquids production, to come up with a number on that is quite challenging. So what I postulated is if you were to move from a gross tax of 13% to a net tax of 13%, but were allowing the investment cost for the gas conversion, that is the item that would move the gas price down 3 to 5 cents. So I think suffice to say these different tax scenarios are complex. I would agree that the net tax system, which operates on the liquids, it is very complex, and it's one of the reasons it's very difficult to model outside, I suspect, the producers themselves. And, you know, I suppose as we approach the LNG project, clearly there are proposals currently in front of this committee and Senate Finance addressing whether changes to the tax regime are appropriate. And it may be that incorporating gas tax considerations within those broader changes might be the appropriate time to do that, given that this LNG project is imminent.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a small clarifying question, Mr. Fulford. When you say lower the price of the gas from 3 to 5 cents, from what baseline? Because it could be, you know, in some measurements, gas is 16 cents. In other measurements, yeah, like at the hub price, it's $1.66 or $3. So what is the 3 to 5 cents coming off of?
That's a very good question, Senator Dunbar. And again, you know, the analysis we did for this is not it's illustrative, but I suppose the conclusions we came to is that if it is $1 billion that's required to invest in the gas conversion, and you know, if we, you know, bearing in mind that upstream rates of return are higher, you know, we assumed a 15% post-tax return, then I think all we could say is that if the gas price is in the region of $1 or $1.25, then that appears to be a quite a robust financial outcome for the producer.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
So just to be clear, when you say reduce 3 to 5 cents, you mean from a price that's somewhere like $1 to $1.25?
Yes, I think in a way the reduction is slightly different depending on the sales price, but you could say it will reduce it from, you know, $1 to 97 cents or from 80 cents to 77. You know, there's, but that gives you a sense of the impact of being able to allow the gas costs in the price. And I would say that all these factors are, these are calculations that the upstream producers will be doing constantly. It will be at their fingertips, and assumptions and calculations could be very different from the numbers I've shared with you today, but obviously we don't have insight into that.
Other questions? Mr. Fulford, when you were talking, you know, as we talk about this, really what you were addressing in terms of the billion-dollar investment was the Point Thompson scenario. Is that accurate?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a good example to take because it's a complex reservoir, and moving it to gas blowdown is not an inconsequential matter. So of all the fields that we're talking about, that's probably a good one to consider.
Thank you for that. I don't see any other questions. I just wanted to make...
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Fulford, we've had an interesting discussion in the last few minutes about tax regimes and tax credits alike. And earlier we were talking about Kitimat. You talked about how they had to negotiate for a tax credit. And I believe you brought up some tax credits in a few other scenarios as well. I seem to remember in previous presentations that you've given over the last year or so, that you've talked about the marginality of this project, of the economics of this project compared to other LNG projects. I'm wondering if, you know, when we're talking about already taking tax credits off of the baseline for all of these other projects that have better economics than ours potentially, if we are expecting that we'd actually need larger tax credits in our project in order to make it work compared to some of these other places.
Yes, thank you, Senator Myers. You know, a very good question. We presented some numbers on Wednesday, which showed that under a range of assumptions, the economic rent available to the Alaska LNG project from the production right through to delivery of the gas in Asia. In some scenarios, it's potentially very attractive. In others, it's not. And as a matter of interest, it's, you know, this question of marginal projects. If you look at the LNG spot prices that were applying back in January, February, and you looked at where Henry Hub was and the gap between the two that essentially is taken up by the cost of liquefaction, even those Gulf Coast LNG export projects were, I would describe, as marginal. Now, obviously, things have changed completely now. Probably will stay that way for many months, even years. But you know, this question of how much profit margin there is and scenarios in which it disappears is key. All I would say is that in the conduct of these negotiations between an LNG project and a government, tax concessions are more frequently required than tax additions. That's, you know, I think if you look back, that would be what one of your findings might be. But it depends entirely on the economics at play.
Follow up, Senator Myers?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. All right, seeing no further questions, I just want to make a couple comments here, mostly for the public that are listening. You know, these LNG contracts are long-term contracts. I mean, we're talking 10 years or more. And as Mr. Fulford just alluded to, things change very rapidly. He talked about marginal Gulf Coast projects just a few months ago. Now, suddenly, they're boomingly valuable and profitable. Well, the terms we set, the structure of our fiscal arrangement is going to be long term for the people of Alaska. And it's one thing to look at what other countries do with more information than we have. Do they have a mandate to their governing body to maximize the benefit for the people of their area, their country? We have that mandate. It's like a fiduciary responsibility, which is very serious. So it's important for the people of Alaska who are listening to understand that we have no financial information. We're working blind here, trying to make logical decisions for a very, very long future, for the future of Alaska. So, yeah, we're going to take time to do it right, I hope. I mean, I hope we get it right. It feels like it's a little bit of a blind shot. But at this time, we will set Senate Bill 275 aside. Our next meeting will be next Monday, the 23rd at 3:30. And at that time, we're going to do appointment confirmation hearings. So we have the DNR commissioner, DC commissioner, AOGCC commissioner, and Big Game Commercial Services Board who will, those appointees will be coming before us. I also have sent Mr. Fulford the new piece of legislation we were offered today, Senate Bill 280. I'm pursuing Pegasus, the other consultant we have, to see what thoughts they have in terms of a fiscal model and advice. So just something to look forward to. At this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:51 p.m.